Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com and communityprogressiveradio.org. Well, I'm afraid I have kind of a sober show for us today. Well, a real sober show for us today. I will be speaking with author Robert Fantina, and among other things, Bob and I will be talking about the U.S.'s impending invasion of Syria. And by the time this airs, that might be the U.S.'s bombardment of Syria. And after Bob, stay tuned, and we'll be speaking with nuclear physicist Arne Gundersen about Fukushima. Our first guest on the soapbox this week is Robert Fantina. Bob is an activist and journalist working for peace and social justice. He moved to Canada shortly after the 2004 election. While working at Northwest Tell in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, he wrote Desertion and the American Soldier, 1776 to 2006. He is currently active in supporting the human rights struggles of the Palestinian people. His new novel entitled Look Not Unto the Morrow is a Vietnam-era anti-war love story. It is available through Whiskey Creek Press. Mr. Fantina now resides in Kitchener, Ontario.
Bob Fantina, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm glad to be here.
And you are calling from our northern neighbor, Canada, right?
Yes, I am. I live near Toronto now.
I love Toronto. What a beautiful city.
It is. It's a wonderful city.
So different from the U.S. too. I always tell people that when you step on someone's foot in Canada, they apologize to you.
Yes, that is a stereotype about Canada. But I do find I lived most of my life in the United States, and I've been in Canada for 8 years, and I do find that there is a great degree of politeness and courtesy here. Not everywhere, of course, but I do find it prevalent.
Well, to me, it's just, you know, and our discussion is not about Canada or Canada, as I like to call it, but, you know, since I've been a peace activist, I've been fortunate to be able to go all over from the West Coast to the East Coast and in the middle, and it's just such a, it looks like, you know, like Homer Simpson calls it, America Junior. It almost looks like we are, you know, that's where we are, but the atmosphere is different. The prevalence of gun ownership in Canada is high, but the murder rate using guns is extremely low. It's the opposite of the United States.
Yes, it is. Hunting is a very popular sport up here, and people do have guns for hunting, certainly. But we don't have the semi-automatic weapons and the used to be called Saturday Night Specials that seem to be so popular in the United States.
Yeah, right. So, you know, and also it's a lot of Canada is still the frontier, and people need the protection, I guess, from I don't eat meat. I'm not a hunter, so I don't support that. But it's just a different culture. So anyway, let's get into your book and let's stop talking about Canada, because Harper wants to make Canada just like the U.S. anyway, take away health care and all kinds of horrible things. But you are an author, and with the United States, you know, spiraling us into what could be World War III. I mean, we've been in almost constant war since World War I, but, you know, now with this threat of actively bombing Syria and not just arming the so-called rebels and arming them and training them, Russia is threatening to attack Saudi Arabia, if that happens, I believe. And it just seems like this country won't be happy until we're in a full-blown World War III. And I met you at the Democracy Conference in Madison, Wisconsin, And you told me about your book, Look Not Into the Morrow. And it's actually a fictional book, but it is set against the backdrop of Vietnam. So, you know, now we have a whole new subset of our culture of returning harmed veterans. So can you tell myself and my listeners about your book?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The book takes place, as you mentioned, with the Vietnam War as a backdrop. The main character is Roger Gaines, who's a young man. The book opens, he's starting his university education with his beloved girlfriend, Pam. They're attending the same school in Madison, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. And he's drafted in his second year there. And he and Pam have not paid much attention to what's going on in the world. They have been wrapped up in their own lives, planning their futures together, attending school and so on. But Roger gets drafted and feels, well, his father served in Korea, and a generation before that it was World War II, and so it's his just his duty. So he goes off to first basic training and then Vietnam. Pam, back home, feels a strong desire to support him, and therefore when he's deployed to Vietnam, she begins studying Vietnam, the war, and U.S. purposes diligently. It isn't, Cindy, reasons for support that she finds. She finds reasons for opposition. And she begins slowly, as her awareness grows, she becomes involved in peace activities that were sometimes violent during the Vietnam War. They sometimes turn violent, and she is at the forefront of these. The book follows both Pam and her activities on U.S. soil and Roger and his activities in Vietnam and the demoralizing, dehumanizing things that he experiences both in training and then in battle and how it changes him and damages him emotionally tremendously. By the time he returns home, Pam has gone underground and is with another man now, and Roger has no self-esteem. He has no confidence. He doesn't know what being home is like. He can't even accept the love that his parents offer him unconditionally. He just doesn't know what that all means anymore. So the book talks about his experiences. Now, while he is a fictional character who was in Vietnam, as you mentioned, another war is about to start, or U.S. involvement in another war is about to start, and more idealistic young men and women will be serving in it and will be coming back as they came back from Vietnam and from Iraq and from Afghanistan, physically and emotionally damaged, hurting and in tremendous pain, and with no resources to really assist them.
Right.
So that's the situation that we're looking at again happening. After the Vietnam War, there was so much talk about, oh, we've learned such important lessons. We can never go into war again unless there's a clear threat to the United States and et cetera, et cetera. We can't do these to our young people, and we can't do this to our young people anymore. But the United States has not learned those lessons.
Well, why do you think that is? Because I actually have written about that and spoken about that too, because if we did learn those lessons, my son would still be alive, and you know, millions of other people around the world. And let's talk about that. Why do you think that it seems like every generation we do get into, even though you know, between we have all these covert actions and you know, what Clinton did, what Carter did, we have actions to arm you know, counter-revolutionaries, we assassinate leaders, we, you know, take over, you know, we put in people, horrible dictators who are friendly to U.S. interests, but awful to their people. So, why do you think that we don't learn that lesson, that we didn't learn the lesson of Vietnam? I'm afraid we're not going to learn the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan. And really, the wars in the Middle East have just been going quite, they've been, haven't stopped. Obama has bombed several more countries since he's been president.
Yes, and I think that you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that the U.S. installs dictators who will support U.S. interests regardless of their unspeakable human rights violations. It all comes down, I think, Cindy, to dollars and cents and power.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S., since its inception, has been interested in power and corporate power, political power and corporate power. The U.S. likes its self-proclaimed image of that beacon of human rights around the world, and it is just such a myth. And while many Americans seem to buy into it, it is not accepted much throughout the world.
Right.
The U.S., as you mentioned, will support counter-revolutionaries, will overthrow democratically elected governments that do not support U.S. corporate and political aims. So the fact that the U.S., it's not that they, I think, hasn't learned the lesson of Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, as you mentioned. I think the people in power don't care. They see the young people of the United States as simply cannon fodder, expendable, disposable, and a never-ending supply of them. And they can be sent anywhere in the world that the United States deems its corporate interests or its political interests are threatened.
Right.
And even if it's a country that perhaps they've recently elected a democratic leader following years of unspeakable torture of their people, that doesn't matter. If the new regime does not support the U.S., does not march lockstep with what the U.S. demands, then they have to go.
Well, the whole thing is, I'm not talking so much about the empire learning this lesson because it's not like this isn't a plan of the empire. They don't think Vietnam was a mistake. They don't think Iraq was a mistake. Afghanistan is a mistake. They just, like you said, it's just this quest for power, political power, and corporate profits. It's why don't we learn the lessons, Bob? Why there's like 300 million people in the United States, and they're the ones who pay the price for this. And I know like when my own son joined in 2000, there had been an actual period where, when Bill Clinton was president, and I am not a Clinton fan at all, but there was a time where, we actually were looking at the military budget, some bases were being closed, and things like that. And so it was a smoke screen, of course, but I was kind of like that person in your book, Pam. I was paying attention, but I wasn't really paying attention. Do you think that might be the problem?
Well that could be part of it. I think there's no easy answer because I ask that same question. I look and I see what's happening and I say, this can't continue, and I moved out of the country because of it. I don't understand why people who have seen their sons and daughters suffer, they themselves have suffered horribly, they've lost loved ones, why they don't, and then they see, what is the point of this? Has this been for some great goal? Has this been for some noble purpose? No, it hasn't been. And even though the soldiers fighting probably believe it is, and I'm not, there's no criticism of them certainly, but I don't understand why people can't say, well, look, as some do, I've interviewed and met with many deserters here in Canada who've said, some of them have served in Iraq or served in Afghanistan. They said, I saw what we were doing over there, and when I was redeployed to go back, I said, no. But so many people can't see this, and I don't know why it is. Partly, I think it's because the U.S. has been so good for generations in proclaiming itself as this leader of freedom and democracy throughout the world, and kind of telling the people, you know, government knows what's best, and the people of Vietnam, for example, going back to the book, they are struggling to establish democracy like we have against communist oppressors.
Right.
All a lie, of course, but people, that resonates. Oh yes, the United States, we're going to help people gain democracy. Well, you know, it has nothing to do with that. And as I've pointed out in different articles I've written, the U.S. populace supports any war that starts, just overwhelming supports any war, and the U.S. government goes in, starts the war, but then when U.S. sentiment changes, as it did in Vietnam, as it did in Iraq, the U.S. is not so quick to end their wars. The government is quick to start them, not to end them. So government likes having that support at the beginning, but doesn't really care about it once it goes on.
We never leave a country. I think Vietnam might be the one example of actually leaving. But now, of course, we have full diplomatic and trade relations with Vietnam. And, you know, another subject that we're not going to get into is why is that, and why do we still have a blockade against Cuba? But let's just stay on the subject for a while. I'm very, like, I just go off into a million different tangents. But because this subject is like so, you wrote this fictional book, but it has so it's so relevant. It has so many ramifications. But the one thing I wanted to ask you, and you said that we always support a war once it starts, and that's really stupid, and that's the truth, but that's really stupid. But one thing is that you mentioned you don't want to say anything bad about the troops that are serving, but why not? And, but I want to just say, and I want to talk about this Vietnam thing. You know, we have this myth that the Vietnam veterans returned and they were spat upon. And, you know, I know that a lot of them weren't treated with very much, just very much respect. But a lot of them were actively involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement also. So do you think that part of this is that there was such a myth about that, how horrible the returning Vietnam vets were treated by the people? Of course they've been treated horribly by our country, because over 100,000 of them have committed suicide. And I think I read where 1 out of 4 homeless people are Vietnam vets.
Yes, I believe that's accurate. Yes, that's another myth, that the Vietnam vets were not treated respectfully when they came home. The government has seemed to have fostered that myth, when it is actually the government that has not treated them well when they came home, or when they went over there, or before they went over there. So soldiers are looked at as heroes, and when I said I don't want to criticize them, what I mean is that many of them, or some of them anyway, go over with noble causes. They think, I'm going to be supporting democracy. Then they, of course, disillusioned, and some of them do desert. But that's one of the myths that the U.S. has perpetrated. A couple of myths. One is that our soldiers are all worthy of tremendous respect, and that deserters are all cowards and traitors. These are two myths that the government continues to foster, and that much of the populace seems to buy into.
Well, just like, of course, what just happened with, Chelsea Manning, also known as Bradley Manning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Seen as a traitor because she exposed atrocities the U.S. was committing. And so who's the criminal here?
Right. She gets persecuted and thrown into prison for decades, but nobody who actually committed the atrocities has even been, put on trial.
And there's little talk of doing that.
Right.
Because it's the big powerful government does what it wants to do, and if one of the little people, Chelsea Manning in this case, decides to point out the evils that the government, the violations of international law that the U.S. government is perpetrating, well, that person is a criminal. I don't get it, but that seems to be the way it's been working.
Well,
we
have a few more minutes, and I'd also like to talk about this other thing. It's the social struggle, even within the anti-war movement here in the U.S. It's like, we should have a draft. If we had a draft, then more people would be out on the streets. And I think that, you know, I actually think that the empire recognized that and saw how it radicalized people. It radicalized students, it radicalized parents, it radicalized mm-hmm. grandparents. So what is your comment about that? Because, of course, most of the soldiers, most of the troops in Vietnam were drafted, of course, and a lot of them actually did enlist, but they didn't in the Navy or the Air Force, so they wouldn't be drafted into the Army.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The draft to me is just another word for slavery, and that's exactly what it is. And so I would never, under any circumstances, support a draft, support anything like a draft. Certainly it did immobilize people and radicalize people a generation ago and would do the same today, but I would not support one evil to accomplish a good. If people can be open to being educated about what's going on, to look beyond what Fox News and MSNBC and CNN is telling them and look a little more in the way of details and go a little more depth, then they will be radicalized because they will see the atrocities that are being committed in their names.
Well, look at the situation we have anyway here in the United States, Bob. It's that the recruiters prey on disadvantaged youth. And now it's a tragic situation where almost all of our youth, except for the children of the 1%, are disadvantaged. College is too expensive. There's no jobs. There's no meaningful employment here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a draft without actually, people call it the poverty draft. It's a draft without actually having a so-called forced conscription.
Yes, it is. And people, unfortunately, young people see the military as offering them some opportunity, educational benefits when they get out and so on, although those educational benefits are very limited, as are the medical benefits when they get out, although the recruiters don't tell them that. And the price they will pay from the time they enter basic training until they are eventually discharged, and of course they sign a contract for 2 years that's meaningless to the United States. The United States government can keep them as long as they choose.
Or 4 years. Yeah, my son signed for 4 years, and he re-enlisted right before he went to Iraq because he was told if he re-enlisted, he'd get a bonus, but if he didn't, he'd have to stay in the Army anyway because he was being stop-loss.
Right. What is the good of a contract if only one party in the contract has to keep the terms?
That is an illegal contract. A unilateral contract is usually not enforceable because it's illegal.
Right. But the U.S. gives itself the authority to enforce it and to imprison and fine people who want it enforced, who say, I served for 2 years or 4 years, whatever it is, that's what I signed up for, now I'm leaving. Well, they can go to prison.
Right, exactly. So, Bob Fantina, we're actually running out of time, but is there something else you'd like to mention? I know I want you to tell my listeners where they can get more information about that book and the other books that you've written, but is there something you'd like to add to the conversation?
I thank you for the time. I've enjoyed the conversation very much. It's probably preaching to the choir to ask your listeners to do all that they can to oppose this new war that the United States is getting involved in. I'll write my letters and make my phone calls, and as I'm sure your listeners will. I don't know what good it'll do. As long as corporate America wants this to happen, it's going to happen.
Right. It's just really that's so few of us left to oppose every war, no matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican that starts it, we're frustrated because we feel like we need to be in the streets, but we don't feel like it's going to stop the war, but
right.
we need to demonstrate our opposition. And if one person can pass by our demonstration, and like we've been talking about, start to think and become radicalized in their own, their own hearts, then to me it's worth being out in the street.
I agree completely.
Okay, Bob, what is your website where my listeners can get more information?
It's robertfantina.com. They can find information on this book and a forthcoming book I have due out in November on the topic of U.S. foreign policy.
Oh, good. Well, we'll have you back. Just let me know when that book's out, and we'll have you back on the show. And I also enjoy the conversation. So, Bob Fantina, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you.
Okay, talk to you soon. And
bye, Cindy.
Stay peaceful up there in Canada.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Our next guest on the Soapbox is Arne Gundersen. Arne has 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, where he earned his bachelor's degree cum laude, while also becoming the recipient of a prestigious Atomic Energy Commission Fellowship for his master's degree in nuclear engineering. Arne holds a nuclear safety patent, was a licensed reactor operator, and is a former nuclear industry senior vice president. During his nuclear power industry career, Arne also managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the United States. I guess he's not a physicist. He is a nuclear power engineer.
Arne Gundersen, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you, Arne, and thank you for all of the work you've been doing around Fukushima and, other compromised nuclear reactors we have around this country and the world. And so I had you on a couple years ago. It was in August of 2011, and it was about, was that like 3 months after the earthquake and tsunami, and the situation at Fukushima was clearly out of control then. For a couple years, to some people, not you and certainly not myself, the issue fell off the radar. It was almost like Fukushima Daiichi was contained and everything was going along swimmingly, but all of a sudden it's exploded, for want of a better word, back into international attention. So what is your, and then also I just recently read that Japan, the Japanese government has taken over containment and cleanup of Fukushima Daiichi. So what is your assessment currently of what's happening there?
Yeah, that's a. I think the things we talked about 2 years ago really have gotten worse, not better, the situation still is on the hairy edge of going out of control, and will continue to be in that situation as long as the present situation in Japan with the Japanese government and with Tokyo Electric is allowed to continue. By that I mean that Tokyo Electric is an operating company. They claim to know how to operate nuclear reactors, but
uh-huh.
I think Fukushima might show that to be wrong too. But
right.
But they're not an engineering firm. And so now we've got the biggest industrial accident in the history of the world, and we're asking a company that's not an engineering firm to manage it. So
right.
they've been down that path for the last 2.5 years, and things are getting worse and more dire as far as the groundwater conditions go and releases to the Pacific under their authority. And I have to blame two parties there. First off, Tokyo Electric is just not competent to do this. But the second piece is that they don't have enough money, and the Japanese government hasn't stepped in and admitted to the Japanese people that there's hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars that are going to be required to stabilize this site and to go through the prefecture and clean it up. Right now, the Japanese government doesn't want the people in Japan to understand that we're looking at essentially a half a trillion dollar expense that's going to come out of their taxes. The Japanese government wants to get new nuclear power plants running in Japan, the ones that have been shut down for 2 years. And the last thing they want to know, they want to tell the Japanese people, is that the situation's much more expensive than they were led to believe.
Well, it seems to me that this is, an international urgency. What is the response from the international community to this? Are there any, countries stepping in and, saying, hey, Cuba, Japan, you're messing up the entire planet. These are the steps that you must take now.
There's been no response from the international community because there's been no request from the Japanese for help. The Japanese are not asking the international community for help. And it's only now that the Pacific Ocean is getting contaminated that the international community is realizing that this is not stopping at the borders of Japan.
Right.
We've got a wedge of cesium and other isotopes about halfway across the Pacific now, and within a year that increased radioactivity in the Pacific will hit the Vancouver and Portland areas and things like that. So it's become an international issue because we're contaminating the Pacific Ocean. And it's not going to go away, Cindy. It's going to continue for years to come. The Japanese government has said, well, we're going to be more proactive in the future and make sure tank XYZ doesn't leak. But in fact, the basements of these buildings are leaking into the groundwater and have been for two-plus years now. So we've got contaminated groundwater that's going to enter the Pacific no matter what.
Mm-hmm. How is I read that 300 million gallons a day are being leaked into the Pacific Ocean. Is that correct?
I'm thinking in tons. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
The number I've heard is 300 tons a day. I'd have to convert tons to gallons. I can't do that while we're on the air here. But that's a guess. It's not like there's a gauge that's measuring this. They know that 1,000 tons a day are leaking onto the site. It's coming out of the mountains and running across, under the buildings. That's been happening since the plant was built 40 years ago. So they have been always pumping these buildings to maintain to keep them dry. Well, of course, the pumps went out and the buildings cracked because of this earthquake. And now they're in a situation where that same 1,000 tons a day is now leaking into the site. And as much as 100 tons a day is leaking into the basements of these buildings. So they've got to build 3 tanks a week to make up for the leakage into these buildings. The basements of these buildings, 40 years ago were clean. But, of course, after the accident, the containment failed. And now we've got radioactivity leaking out of the containment through penetration, through electrical wiring and through pipelines and through broken doors and things like that into other buildings. So the entire basement of this entire facility is radioactive with really hot radioactive material. you know, lethal levels of radioactive material in the basements of these buildings. And now fresh water comes in, lies on it, absorbs some of that radiation, and goes out into the Pacific. It's inevitable that contamination of the Pacific will continue for years to come.
You had recommended building a trench around the plant and filling it, I think, with volcanic ash. And am I correct?
Yeah, I had recommended 2 years ago that that the Japanese go on the not on the water side. The problem is not keeping the radioactivity out of the ocean. The problem is keeping the clean water out of the plant. So
right.
I had recommended on the high side of the plant, on the inland side of the plant, that a zeolite trench, volcanic ash trench, be installed. And outside that trench, I think the secret is to pump the groundwater down to keep the clean water from coming into the plant. You know, once it's in the plant, it's hard to prevent it from entering the Pacific. So my goal 2 years ago was to pull the groundwater down, and the zeolite would prevent any of the radiation that was already in the plant from coming back onto the land side. You know, now we're in a situation where the horse is already out of the barn. The Japanese have already contaminated the groundwater, so the process becomes much more costly. You know that line of stitch in time saves nine.
Right.
They never really understood 2 years ago that they didn't have control, and it's now out of control. And to bring it back in, a lot more expensive than it would have been if they had done it right back 2 years ago.
So if they had unlimited resources, TEPCO in Japan, and the will to do this, what can be done now to contain it and repair and clean up?
Yeah. There's no solution that's going to take, you know, a year. I mean, we're looking at a five-year problem minimum, and likely a 10-year problem minimum. They've got to stop the clean water from coming in. Now, that means the same techniques I recommended 2 years ago, but they have to be further away from the plant, which means a bigger trench and more costs. So if they can pull down the water table of water entering the site, and that would be clean water. They could pump that right into the Pacific, because it's clean water. It hasn't been contaminated.
Right.
And that zeolite trench prevents the cross-contamination. If they can do that, then they don't have to build any more tanks. At that point, the leakage into the buildings will begin to stop, and eventually will stop completely, because that groundwater that's already contaminated on site is going to leach into the Pacific. There's no way to stop that. The solution has got to be, how are we going to prevent this from continuing 5 years from now? But, you know, the Japanese have to admit to the international community that the Pacific is going to be continually contaminated for at least five more years. You know, Woods Hole has already said that this is the in terms of aquatic contamination, Fukushima is already 10 times worse than Chernobyl. The releases into the ground table at Chernobyl and then into bodies of water were only one-tenth of what Fukushima is pumping into the Pacific. So it's a serious problem. It's going to be a serious problem. But unless you've got the will and unless you've got the money, I don't see this thing ending for decades. I think with the will and with the money, you can begin to turn the curve in about 5 years.
From what I understand, the tanks that they're building aren't that strong. I mean, they're very inadequate.
You know, I've seen some harebrained schemes, and the latest one that they're recommending is to put in a wall of ice.
I saw that.
Ice has been used in construction before. The Italians used it to push the leaning tower of Pisa back up a little bit. it had leaned a couple degrees too far and was in danger of collapsing. So they put ice in the ground, and that expanded the ground, and the building got straight. And then they reinforced it from below to prevent it from recurring. So the use of ice to freeze the ground is not unheard of. But they're talking about a two-mile wall of ice with enormous power consumption to keep this thing frozen. And it just seems to me that it's so prone to problems. Like, what happens if you lose power? This isn't something you have your little emergency generator and turn it back on. You know, this is an enormous consumer of electricity to freeze the earth and keep it frozen for you know, essentially decades. So I think it's a sign of the desperation at Tokyo Electric that they're even considering something like a wall of ice in the ground to prevent the flow of radioactive material.
This is like certainly a doomsday situation here. And what is the implications for you know, the all this contaminated water leaking into the Pacific Ocean? And you said it'll soon be, the currents will bring it to Vancouver, Portland area. What is the environmental and the prediction for how it's going to affect, life on this planet?
Yeah, you know, you're right. That's this is, we're used to solutions that can be solved in, you know, in a TV episode. And unfortunately,
right.
This is more like a horror movie where the beast never gets killed. The worst is yet to come for the Pacific. And right now we're seeing a wedge of contaminated water. The Pacific has had cesium in it since the bomb testing, but the contamination in this wedge is 10 times higher than what it was before. And it's likely to grow because, you know, this plant is still leaking. So now, luckily, the Pacific's a big place. So the cesium that's leaking in is being diluted into a huge body of water. The lesson for policymakers here should be, you know, what if this happened on the Mississippi, or what if this happened on the Great Lakes or the Rhine or the Danube or whatever? We could wipe out the water supply for 40 million people if this happened at an inland site. So with it leaking into the Pacific and being diluted by a huge amount of water, that's the good news. The bad news, though, is that all of the organisms in the Pacific, you know, the fish and the plants that grow on the bottom of the Pacific, and it will work its way up the food chain, are becoming more contaminated with cesium-137 than they had been in the past. We don't have any good fish data. And I think that if there's an ask here for your listeners, start demanding of Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein and senators up in Oregon and Washington to, one, monitor the fish, but two, make that information publicly available. We need a transparent process where the government monitors and then tells us as citizens what it is we're eating. Right after the accident, we found contaminated tuna in California. Within 5 months, they had swam across the Pacific. So the question is, it seems that as a result of that scare, the government's position was, let's not monitor anymore. And
right.
I don't think that's a good process. I think we as citizens need to know what it is we're eating. So, you know, my attitude toward that is I'm demanding of my congressman that I want an open and transparent process here. What's coming out of the Pacific? And then I'll make a choice whether or not I want to buy it. But absent that information, my choice is I'm not going to buy it because I don't know what's being hidden by the government. So The health effects, you know, the beer, the biological effects of ionizing radiation, is a committee that wrote a report, and they said any increase in radiation is harmful. So when I hear health authorities say, oh, there's no harm here, how
right.
can it be when it's 10 times more radioactive than it was before? You're also exposing a huge population along the Pacific Rim. So, you know, statistically, it's going to be hard to prove who it is who got the additional cancer, but obviously there's going to be additional cancers from this, from the spread of this radiation.
So we should be demanding of our politicians to have a transparent, to reveal things and to investigate and make sure that the citizenry know so we can make an informed choice. But what about just, you know, calling for a boycott of Pacific seafood, and then have the people who depend on that, their livelihood, you know, this is capitalism. They're going to, if we boycott, they're going to be losing profits. And it seems like our government would listen to them more than they would listen to us, because, you know, transparency might hurt them, but, you know, a boycott would definitely hurt them.
Yeah, I hate to call for a boycott, but essentially that's, you know, what personally I'm doing. You know, I've decided that this is the last year I'm going to eat fish from the Pacific until I've got a transparent process. But that's a personal decision. I didn't think of it as a political process. And I think a lot of people need to make personal decisions and let their congressman know, you know, I'm not going to eat this fish until I know what's in it. And you owe it to me to we know you're taking the data. You owe it to me to tell me exactly what the radiation concentrations are. The last thing we need is for, there was a couple fish caught out about 200 miles away from Fukushima that were extraordinarily radioactive, you know, the kind that would potentially set off a radiation alarm if one were in place. And no one understands how a fish 200 miles away could get that radioactive. So there's a lot of processes in play here that we don't understand fully as scientists or as citizens. So I think, a small sampling program is inadequate. I've heard that the government tested, in 2011, they tested like 200 extra fish for radiation out of the millions and billions that come into the country. So we've got an inadequate program that citizens have no control over. We got to get control back. And, my attitude is it's a personal choice, and I would, I'm gonna stop eating it, and I'm going to let the suppliers know that I've made that choice. And if enough of us do that, we effectively change the market. But I'm a little hesitant to call for a boycott. You know, that's not what Fairwinds does. We're not political, and we're more of an energy consultancy than a political entity.
I totally understand about that. The thing is, though, and we just have a couple minutes because I know you have to prepare for another interview right away, but here in the United States, eating fish is, it's not, I don't want to say it's a luxury, but, you know, how people eat fish maybe once a week, couple times a month maybe. In Japan, it's a staple of their diet. And
mm-hmm.
How is this affecting, do you know how this is affecting the consumer in Japan?
Yeah, well, the Japanese fishermen in Fukushima Prefecture, which is a little less than 100 miles of coastline, have been told they can't fish. So that means, 100 miles of the Pacific is not being fished, but yet we've got these outliers. We've got these fish that are beyond that are still getting caught. The other
mm-hmm.
part of the problem is that the only thing governments of the world are looking at right now is cesium-137. And that blows through muscle over a period. It's a muscle seeker. And over a period of months, the fish will wear that out of their system. The other isotope, though, is strontium-90. That's a bone seeker. And the Japanese in particular need to measure the fish that they're eating, not just for cesium-137, which is easy to detect, but for strontium-90. And the reason is that the Japanese cook a lot of stew. And when you do a fish stew, the bones are in the fish. So that the heating brings the strontium-90 out. So until the Japanese authorities especially look at not just the meat of the fish for the cesium, but they also look at the bone of the fish for the strontium. If I were a consumer of Japanese fish in Japan, I would not eat it, even if forced to eat it.
I'm actually a vegan, and so when I went to Japan a couple of years ago around this issue, I found it very hard to find things to eat. I lost 8 pounds there because it's such a culture that is, their food is based on animal product and fish products. So, oh gosh, I just wish so much good for this planet. And my other guest this week is about Syria. And I just want to maybe call this eat, drink, and be merry because, we're facing some serious, serious times here.
You know, the nuclear industry doesn't believe that an accident like Fukushima is possible. They call it, they say it falls outside the design basis. It's called the beyond design basis accident. So they give it a probability of 1 in 1 million or 1 in 100 million. And then they lowball the costs associated with it. And the net effect is we continue to do this even though we've seen it happen. So basically,
right, it's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. What happens can't happen if you listen to the nuclear industry.
So it's not happening. Oh, my God.
Yeah, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain kind of a thing, which is truly we are moving forward knowing that an accident happened and ignoring its consequences. And that's, as a society, that's really a frightening place to be.
I think I read an interview you did or saw an interview where you're saying that you said something like it's happened, instead of being a 1 in 100 million, it's happened like once every 5 years or something like that.
Oh yeah, that's the math is
crazy.
The math is really simple. If you take 1 in 1 million, the nuclear industry says 1 in 1 million, and if you take 400 plants, so it's 1 million on top and 400 on the bottom, you wind up with an accident, something like every 200 to 2,000 years. But
right.
If you look at reality, we've had Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and 3 meltdowns at Fukushima, 5 meltdowns in 35 years. So that's one accident every 7 years.
Right.
So the numbers show 1 in 200 or 2,000, but yet the data, the real history, shows once every 7 years. How can we ignore history, to feed our addiction? We're addicted to this energy, and we're feeding the addiction, ignoring the fact that we've got, dire consequences about once a decade.
Well, Arne Gunderson, thanks so much for being on the show, and I just want you to tell my listeners your website. My listeners are very smart and on top of these issues, but your website has probably some of the best information, reality-based information about what's happening today.
Yeah, thank you. The site is Fairwinds. And it's got an E in the middle of it, Fairewinds, fairwinds.org. And, we've designed a very user-friendly site that's very searchable for lots of things. So encourage your readers to visit it.
Well, thank you so much, Arne. I know you're really busy, and thanks for giving Cindy Sheehan Soapbox some of your time.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that's probably the most sobering soapbox we've had on for a while. We speak the truth. We speak truth to power. We speak truth even when our voices are shaking. But this one is actually pretty scary. So do what Arnie said. Let's get on the horns and demand that our government becomes very proactive in this Fukushima disaster and that we end nuclear power as an energy source. Along with fossil fuels, we have the technology for clean, renewable, and sustainable forms of energy. So anyway, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, and with Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank Bob and Arnie for taking the time to being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.